This videotape is edited from an advanced NLP training in Boulder, Colorado, April 1989. Many of the participants had also attended previous advanced training with Richard. Richard considers this seminar to be his best ever presentation of how he works with clients. Although he presents some new submodality methods, his major emphasis is on how he puts things together and the methods that he uses to create lasting change. Since this is a carefully sequenced seminar, we recommend viewing the videotapes in order.
Okay. Wanted to take a few minutes this morning before we dive into a little more stuff about time. I hate to put people in trance when they first wake up. Sometimes you can't get them back. But I wanted to ask you if you came up with some other sorts of things that you'd like to cover, if you had some good ideas. Yeah.
Integration of disassociated states without using six-step reframing.
Yeah, that's fun. There's all kinds of weird ways you can do that. We can get into that. That's a good idea. Do you guys know what he means by disassociated states? Have you got some? Think about your disassociated states now. There's a lot of times you find that there are behaviors that people have that they don't count as themselves. And one of the reasons that they have trouble dealing with it, a lot of alcoholics are like that. They don't count their drinking as part of their own behavior. And that's one of the reasons. It's like, you know, they only do certain things when they're drunk, especially bad drunks. Instead of assuming that they're, you know, the part of their personality that's just obnoxious and doing something about the obnoxious part of themselves, they say, it's the alcohol. Like the alcohol has bad tonality in the bottle, you know, and bad manners, you know. Let's have two shots of bad manners and bad tonality. Unfortunately, it does not affect everybody that way, so it should dawn on them that it must be them doing it. Whereas if they integrated the behaviors, they could actually alter the behaviors and probably end up drinking as well without becoming an obnoxious person. I don't know how many of you know people who are obnoxious drunks, but they either need to be integrated or clubbed. Should take them out, put them in little white seal outfits, and put them out in the snow at a certain time of year. Give them a couple of drinks. Hide the seals. What other kinds of things did you come up with that you'd like to do as long as we have some time? Yeah.
I'd like to get some input on how to establish curiosity in a work group that I'm in now.
What do you mean, establish curiosity?
Well, it seems like it's kind of dormant at this point.
You have a work group, like an NLP work group? Or
no, it's a sales organization.
Where sales people have in a group of salespeople, curiosity is gone? Yeah. Yeah, that's where you really need it. When salesmen go dormant, they get poor quickly.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that I really spent time doing was studying the top salespeople and finding out, and they are a ferocious crew. And I have a group of people that I met. This is top insurance salespeople back east in one particular company. And one of the things that is amazing about them is that this is one of the most curious group of people I've ever worked with. And they're insatiable. And one of the things that they have built in is they have a set of beliefs that they have built into themselves. I mean, their beliefs themselves are not genetic. And one of the most powerful ones they have that I also find is rampant in really good neuro-linguistic programmers is that challenge is fun. The more challenging something is, the more they drool out of the corner of their mouths. That they're out there looking for the hard sell, not the easy sell. And that a lot of salespeople, you know, if something is difficult at all, that's where they have a tendency to back off from it. And that you'll find that, do you get to do things to these people? Overtly.
Yeah, I can do overtly or covertly, either one.
Well, I always like to mix them up, you know.
Yeah.
But as long as you can do overt things, that one of the things you can do is to really do some belief installation. And belief installation, I mean, where you go and sit down, find out what the strongest beliefs that they have are, and find out which ones override which ones. Because belief systems are interesting in that there are very strong beliefs that people have that becomes suspended at a certain point in time. And you have to have that kind of stuff. I mean, as mostly that you can find that out by asking about survival situations and when you touch on ethics. empathy. Like a lot of salesmen will use all the techniques they use, but not with relatives, whereas others will use them only with relatives and not with other people. you recognize this phenomenon. And sometimes, I mean, I've found that, you know, there are salesmen that have the greatest pitches, but they use them with everyone but their clients. I mean, you know, the other salespeople, telling people how great their job is, relatives, people like that, friends. But until they know somebody, they don't use their really good skills. And it's like, if you can alter the belief system so that that's when they're operational, you can do some real high-powered stuff. We can do some stuff about investigating beliefs. That's always fun. I like tearing beliefs apart myself, especially the ones that limit people, you know. That if they do stuff, that people won't like them. A lot of salesmen are much too timid, and that's one of the reasons they don't enjoy their job. When people walk in the door, they don't have that attitude where they look at them and say to themselves, "You're mine." You know, they don't see people walking into the palm of their hand as they march through the door. They look at them and they make them larger than life, and they're afraid they'll offend them and all kinds of stuff. And it isn't productive. Most of the good salesmen also have a tendency to run scenarios. They have a generative machine built into their head where they run worst-case scenarios. They literally make up the most difficult client they can imagine in their head, and then they start running, you know, over and over and over. They go into a state of time distortion, which is kind of convenient because that's where we're leading into. One of the advantages of being able to do accelerated time states is that you can run massive numbers of scenarios, try different options about what to do in certain situations. And see, one of the things that's always helped me with clients because a lot of the clients that I get are pretty weird. And I used to have a group of psychiatrists that would refer me what I classified as impossibles. I said, anything that nobody can do. And they had to have been to at least 5 or 6 therapists, and they had to be people that were given up on. And when people would come in, you know, it's like I had to run different cases in terms of trying to figure out, because, you know, my theory of schizophrenia is really fairly simple. If somebody's schizophrenic, that's because they're not in touch with reality. So the trick is to make whatever they're schizophrenic about real. And it's kind of the opposite of what everybody else does. Everybody wants to put them in touch with reality. And I figure if you make their schizophrenia real, especially in the context where you can control the environment. We were talking yesterday, and one of the things that, you know, that I said is that I always believe that the people that are given up on in mental hospitals, the ones that are considered chronic and terminal, and, you know, where they don't actually even treat them anymore, there are whole wards full of these people roaming around mental hospitals, that since they've given them up for dead, that what they should do is take these people and give them to grad students. You know, and I mean, because, I mean, I don't know how many of you went to grad school in the field of psychology, but mostly all people do is statistics. And I mean, which is ludicrous if you think about it. I mean, it's to begin with the last thing anybody needs. Plus, they're sent, I mean, not so much now, but I mean, it really used to be true that, I mean, people would graduate with a PhD in psychology and they would and get licensed and they would have never seen a client. Not one. And I mean, now even in colleges, at least they have things like peer counseling classes and stuff. People who like actually got to talk to somebody. And, I mean, it. You know, how would you feel about it if, you know, somebody got their license in surgery and had never cut open a frog or anything, you know? I mean, it's one of the things you don't want to be as a surgeon's first. I mean, I think that's why they use cadavers. At least I hope they do. But, I mean, to turn people loose. But, see, I figured if they took these people and really got grad students to try anything under the sun, then what would happen is to begin with, a new, brand new technology would be developed in the field, because the field of psychology has been rather dormant, as far as I can tell. And that new technology would be developed, but also, after working with people that are that far out there, when people actually started working in the field and seeing clients, that they would be less likely to get hooked into their difficulties. They wouldn't seem so severe. Plus, they would learn to distrust people enough that they didn't get hooked into their problems. Because, you know, I've done a lot of things with clients, especially ones who have been through too much therapy. You know, like I've had people that, you know, told me horrendous stories about being beaten up by their parents when they were little and all of this stuff, and this is where all their traumas came from, and actually did regression with hypnosis and found out none of it happened. I mean, literally, none of it happened. And that, you know, they had taken, you know, a couple of small spankings and literally blown them out of proportion. there was a period, I don't know, it must have been about 10, 12 years ago, where there was a group of therapists that themselves had been beaten up as children who decided that everybody had been beaten up as children, and that was the basis of all of your problems, was that all children were actually abused children. You either had to be beaten up or molested, and that everybody was by someone, and it was only a question of whom. And well, it was doctors, you know, next-door neighbors, aunts, uncles, relatives, but I mean, every presupposition in their language, because I got this student, I had a grad student who came in, and this is the God's honest truth, who came in and said, Richard, I need you to help me personally. And I said, well, you know, I don't normally do that with students. And she said, well, this is pretty serious. And I said, what is it? And she said, I've been raped, and I don't know it. Now, I don't know about you, but that strikes me as one of those sentences where your brain goes, whoop. And I looked at her and I said, if you don't know it, how can you tell me? And she said, well, my therapist found it out. And I said, did your therapist call some of your relatives? She went, no. And so, being the kind of guy I was, I gave her a tape recorder and I told her to tape her next session. And I listened to it and literally, at least every other sentence had the presupposition in it that she had been molested when she was young. I mean, and now if you sit there and lay the same presupposition on somebody, embedded, double embedded, triple embedded, for an hour. See, I found out if you stack three presuppositions, you can slide just about anything in. But if you did it for an hour, you would have people utterly and absolutely convinced. And it just didn't happen. I mean, I hypnotized her, regressed her, searched all around. It just didn't happen. But this particular therapist believed that if you had a sexual problem, it was because you were molested as a child, period. And there is no other, you know, it couldn't be that you just didn't know what the hell you were doing. Couldn't be something simple like that. Couldn't be the fact that the first time you had sex, you were scared out of your mind, so you anchored it, you know, which is always a great way to begin your sex life. Scare the hell out of somebody and show them their first naked person of the opposite sex. There's a good system. Well, I mean, this kind of stuff happens all the time. I mean, I found through the years that most of the problems that people have aren't as serious as they blow them out to be. And one of the things is that I had the advantage in that I was building a technology to get results in the future. And I really didn't care about the past because I don't believe in causal relationships. I mean, my background in physics taught me that the causal universe is simply a fallacy. I mean, the Newtonian universe that X causes Y, it just doesn't work that way. I mean, when I was doing physics, they'd already dropped that. You know, we moved on to Einstein. In fact, they're beyond Einstein. Now they know his theories are bunk. But in terms of causal relationships, you see, if having something happen to you when you were 5 makes you have a problem when you're older, then there'd be nothing you could do about it. That would be that. It would be the end of it. And it would mean that everybody that happened to would have that problem. And it just doesn't work out that way. I mean, some people, you know, become, you know, very introverted, you know, who were beaten up as children. And some people become total extroverts. Some end up with sexual problems and some don't. So it's not that simple, because what they found out is that things operate in relationship to a lot of nonlinear variables, and it just isn't predictable in that way. And since I don't believe that things cause things, when people tell me about traumatic past experiences, to begin with, I don't even know if they're right. Because, you know, if, I don't know, have any of you ever been to a Virginia Satir workshop? In here, which the first time I went to one of her workshops, she did something which I thought was interesting. She made people who are therapists, in particular, get down on their knees between two. She took the two tallest adults in the group. You know, there was one guy that was like 7 foot and a woman who was 6'4", right? And had them hold their hands like adults do with kids, stand between them, do things like lean over, you know, and pinch them on the cheeks and stuff, so that they would know what it's like from a child's point of view. Spooky stuff, let me tell you. You know, and some giant person comes down and goes, hi, how are you? Ah! You know, that's the stuff nightmares are made of. And so from the point of view of a child, that things can seem, you know, because a lot of times people, I remember that one of my clients telling me about his father, and he was this big guy, and he was brutal, and he was all this stuff and mean, you know, and I had this picture of this football player. And finally, one time, he said his dad was actually coming to town. He was terrified to go see him and stuff. And so I said, well, I'll have him meet you here. So a guy walks in my office. The guy comes up to about here on me, right? My client is about a foot taller than I am, right? And after the session, my client still didn't know. When I said, did you notice that, you know, you're 2.5 feet taller than your dad? And he went, I am not. And I mean, in his eyes, he was still looking through the old grids. And, you know, and if he'd have, like, stood up and walked up next to his dad, but, I mean, as soon as his dad walked in, he sat down because that's the position he knew to look at him from. It was familiar. And there is a thing about generalizations. One of the things that you will find about human beings that's the most true is that human beings have a tendency to do what's familiar, even more than what's safe. You know, that that if you consider that people think about suicide, right, you know, that the survival instinct, I don't think, is as strong as doing what's familiar. That's why you have people that have like 7 or 8 suicide attempts. I mean, give me a break, 7 or 8 suicide attempts. I mean, you know, if there's one thing you should be able to get right, it's killing yourself. I mean, give me a break. You go up to a tall building, you throw yourself off. That's a one-shot deal, you know. I mean, you know, but I mean, and these people, I mean, they can take, you know, I know and have had clients that have like slit their wrists 6 or 7 times. What, they didn't notice the first 2 times it didn't work? You know. Plus, you know, they slit their wrists this way. Everybody's watched enough TV to know you slit them this way. And I mean, it's the kind of thing is that to them, I mean, even hurting themselves, I mean, think about these people walking across hot coals, right? They're not thinking real clearly. Paying money to walk across hot coals. Think about it, right? All right, okay, you can go on a vacation to Hawaii, or you can walk, for the same price, you can walk across hot coals. Hawaii, hot coals. Hawaii, hot coals. Now, not only that, they come up to me and brag. Listen to this. They brag to me, of all people. They come up and they go, I've done the firewalk 16 times. And I go, you know, I mean, it's like I go, Hawaii, hot coals. You know, it seems pretty overt to me. But the thing about, you know, when walking across hot coals now has become familiar to them. You know, I mean, and to me especially, you know, to go and pay again to do it, think of how much, you know, tan bark and gasoline you could buy for that price. They could be walking across hot coals every day for the price of that. I mean, if you could be having some outrageous barbecues. I mean, you know, you could throw in the steaks and the potatoes for that price. I mean, to me, that human beings that in terms of doing protecting themselves and their own welfare, that's a new generalization for most people. For example, most of the clients I work with, the idea of aiming towards ecstasy and enjoyment is not the way they've directed their life. Then, I mean, one of the things I try to instill in all my clients is to do things in their own best interest. And you would think that would be a prime directive of being a human being, is doing things that are in your own best interest. But that's not at all the case. Lots of human beings do, and I mean, if you think about it, just kind of roam back in your history a little bit, and think about how many things you've done, and while you knew you were doing them, you knew they were stupid, right? And something propelled you to do them anyway. So something seemed so important, you know. I mean, if your boyfriend drops you, you know, so you're going to go out and get drunk and go drive your car off a cliff. That'll show them, you know, make it easy for them is what it'll do. And, you know, either that or you'll go out with people you don't like, you know. Stuff like that, you know. I see this kind of stuff in human beings a lot. Rather than they're having the ability to know how to put something in the past and not care about it. Because one of the things is that when human beings get locked into something being familiar to care about, it's hard for them to stop caring about it. It's one of the reasons people have so much trouble with relationships ending. You know, you would think that, you know, if somebody goes, I don't love you anymore, I don't like you, in fact, I can't even stand being around you, that would be enough. You know, that something inside your brain would go, all right. But instead it goes, if you don't love me, I'll die. You know, it's as if they want somebody to pretend to love them who hates their guts. But something inside their brain in the stupid center, you know, a switch flicks over and goes, I'm going to get you to act like an idiot for at least 3 months. And one of the things that, well, it's true. I see this shit all the time, man. It's like, you know, you think you've been dumb before. Watch this. Click. The switches go over. And, you know, and then the dumb juice comes out, and you start getting mad about things you don't even care about. You know, you start doing things you don't even want to do. And you start hanging around with people you don't like either. Because after all, if you want somebody who doesn't like you to hang around with you, then you should hang around with people you don't like. It makes sense, doesn't it? There is a certain perverse logic to it. And to me, one of the things about really learning to run your brain is to learn how to put things behind you. Learning how to make yourself be able to not care about things that you really don't care about. I mean, because if somebody doesn't like you and you're in a bad relationship, like, you know, that a more appropriate response should be relief. You didn't have to be the one to say it. But somehow or other, this thing kicks off in people. And they don't realize that time is a very relative phenomenon. And see, like, one of the things that I've used, like the exercise we did at the end of yesterday, too, is when I've had people that, you know, that when they were in a bad situation and they couldn't get out of it, they tell me that. And, you know, and I always go, look, you know, don't you know where the door is? You know, I mean, it seems to me they go, well, you know, I'm stuck in a bad relationship. And I go, you know, like, what stops you from leaving? And they go, well, I just can't, you know, because if I do, I don't know what he'll do to himself. And I go, what difference does it make? You don't like him. Well, yes, but I used to like him. So I still care about him. I just don't love him. I love him, but I'm not in love with him. Now, even your brain's got to be able to go, man, we're way into the fudge factor now. You know, if you had a little voice inside you that just whistled, had a loud whistle, went, yo, you know, listen to yourself talking. So I'm going to sacrifice. So one of the things I do with people is I take and I have them go, well, if it took you 6 more months to get out, what we're going to do is go through those 6 months. And then I take the same types of submodalities as waiting in line. Right? And I have them move through those 6 months and have it take forever. So that even things like going through, like I usually start with just one long dinner. Right? Sitting across the table where it seems like it takes an hour for the other person to get a spoon up. Right? Because I've discovered one of the things that's a useful response in human beings can be impatience. That there's a whole lot of waiting going on in human beings, and that the waiting itself is, I don't know why they're waiting for, but it's a natural response, and I think that we're trained very, very young to wait for things, you know, to wait for meals, to wait for other people, to wait in line. And especially when you're children, you spend a lot of your time waiting for adults. You know, I mean, you know, they tell you to get ready to go somewhere, and you get your coat on, and you're all ready, and then they sit and talk to somebody. And, of course, when you're a kid, you know, you've only been alive for a short period of time. Remember when you were children, you know, that a month seemed like forever? And now they go by whoosh, like this? Well, I mean, when you were 5 years old, and you had to wait 10 minutes for your mother, you know, to put on that last dash of makeup, you know, that seemed like an eternity. And you were taught that you had to wait, and wait, and wait. And as you get older, that those waiting programs operate automatically. And knocking some of those out, one of the things that's very useful that I thought we might start with this morning is learning how to blow them apart. Now, most of you in here know the threshold pattern, right? You know what the threshold pattern is? That's where you turn submodalities up till things get so horrible that it cracks. I was talking yesterday about somebody finally told me what codependency is. Silly me, I thought that's where you took more than one drug. It sounds like it. Here, all this time, these psychologists always come up with these words, and I always get them wrong. But anyway, the situation the person was describing to me is that they have a client who is so in love with a junkie, and the junkie abuses them, treats them badly, beats them up, and they do disassociation for the other person. They go, oh, it's just the drugs. He's not really that way. Now, somebody been beating you up for 4 or 5 years. I mean, I think your brain should accept that that's the way they are, you know, and that, you know, maybe going away is a good idea. And one of the things that I explained to him is that the kind of pattern that we use is a pattern that since anything that human beings can be done can be learned, that the way to learn it is to find out how people fall out of love. Because people do it all the time. So if we have somebody, we now have somebody who needs to, right, which is not the common situation. Most people need not to. But if you have somebody, and I mean, it's a fairly easy thing to do, because the difference is between when people are in love, they're associated with the good times and disassociated from the bad times. And I mean, if you think about, like if you live with somebody and you think about memories that you have with them, if you disassociate from the bad ones and associate with the good ones, you will feel more in love with them. Now, that doesn't make sense, doesn't it? Think about it just as a formula. And if you spend time, you know, doing this, you know, a little bit every day, you will build and you'll get more back into the state when you first fell in love than you ever were. In fact, you'll get more into it than you were when you were there, because that's what it's made out of. I mean, when you take people who are in love, doesn't matter, no matter what happens, because when they think about it, they're disassociated and the pictures are far away. Now, so if you have somebody you want to fall out of love, the thing is what you do is you take at more than five, because it has to do with frequency and how close together. Because you always hear it's called the last straw. You know, the straw that, you know, it's just, that was the last one. And the pictures flip. And suddenly, people are associated with all the bad stuff and disassociated from everything good. And that's what it takes to fall out of love. And then you run about 15, 20 of those real fast, and it stays that way. Just like all the threshold patterns do. And you can do this by, you take the bad ones, and you amplify all the submodalities that make it hurt right through the ceiling. You make them bigger, closer, brighter, louder, and louder, and louder, until it hits the point where the pictures flip to the other kind. Now, what I suggest is that there's another way also, not only of taking the submodalities, but of using time as the control variable, to be able to create the threshold phenomenon. Now, yesterday what we were doing, the reason I was getting you to build a rheostat for time, something where you could hear it click one way and hear it click the other way, there's two parts to that. One of the things I've discovered in the past few years is people do not make very much use of their auditory system in terms of auditory tonal. That this is, you know, other than replaying McDonald's commercials, stuff like that, that they don't seem to utilize it, and especially neurolinguistic programmers don't utilize it in terms of all the naturally occurring anchors. Because you know all these pictures you're making in your heads and the submodalities and that stuff works because they're anchors. When you think about a time, a pleasant past memory, and it makes you feel good, that's because the picture is an anchor. Well, the same thing is true about sounds like thunder, sounds of bolts shutting, all the naturally occurring sounds that automatically tell you things, that you've grown neural networks that access all the kinesthetics that go with that, the sound of locks shutting. I mean, when you hear a deadbolt click shut, you know what that means. I mean, you don't have to look through the crack to know the deadbolt shut, unless you're real disassociated or real deaf, one or the other. But I mean, you know when you turn a deadbolt, you can hear the sound of it clamping shut. And you've learned this, and you know it not just at the level, but you also, when you hear that sound, you also know the feeling that goes with it. You know, the feeling of a door not being able to open. All of those things are connected together. Now, being able to utilize the sounds that are of something that clicks one way and clicks another way, all of the naturally occurring things that occur inside of our lives. See, one of the things I like about video games now, having played enough video games now, I now have video arcade sounds inside of my head. I don't know how many of you have gotten hooked on these things, but like we were talking, somebody was going to go to South Lake or Vegas, and they were asking, you know, of a way to store cards so they could count cards visually, you know, and when I play blackjack, I have the deck of cards up in the corner, right? And as a card comes face up, it blacks out on my deck so I know what cards are left. But when it does it, it also makes one of those video sounds. When it turns over, it does that, and then gets a little red X over it. And so I go through, and that way I know what cards are left in the deck, and it tells you what the odds are of getting the kind of cards that you want. And after you start doing that for a while, I don't know, I've noticed that I've begun to have that a lot of the things that I do inside of my head now become games. That, you know, it's like, what do you want for lunch? And it puts all this stuff up and it blinks on and off. How many of you have gotten a Macintosh? Have you become Macintosh thinkers internally? Do you now have scrolls that come up? Everything. I find myself moving the mouse on my leg now, and my internal images are shifting in Maclang. I have menus that come down and they blink, and I have a little black thing that goes up and down. When it gets there, I press a button and pictures pop in my head and stuff. Because that's because the outside world affects us. See, I discovered a long time ago, I used to work as a photographer when I was in college. And the cameras we used had a little crosshaired thing in it with a little circle around it. When the circle was clear, it was focused. And I discovered if I worked on a shoot for 15 hours, when I put the camera down, that was still there. And it would stay, you know, well, you're staring into these bright lights and stuff, and I mean, it would stay there. But after a while, I discovered it was there all the time, right? That when I focused my eyes across the room, this little thing would get clear when I focused. If I looked at a person, it would be blurry till I focused it, right? Which I decided wasn't useful because I kept running into things because it was in the way. But the point I'm trying to make is that the external representations around you become a part of your internal representations because that's what they're built out of. And that utilizing sound as a control mechanism, especially since most people don't use the tonal sounds for much of anything other than to scare themselves, in the middle of the night, you know, people hear noises. I love it. You turn the lights out, people are beginning to hear noises immediately, even if there aren't any. It's like a partial sensory deprivation tank, right? Since most people don't use much auditory internal, that what happens is if you just make a room dark, people go, "What was that sound?" Because they begin to hallucinate sounds. It's the easiest system for them to hallucinate in because it's the system they have least control over. So also adding the dimension of having sound control into people's lives gives them more control over their brain because it'll be the system that'll be the most out of control. Learning to be able... See, for example, one of the things that I started doing was taking sounds that people don't like and associating them with things when they're trying to break habits. I have a friend that had a habit, which was, I don't know how he developed, but he developed amazing sensory acuity to the point where he could walk in any place and know who had drugs. I mean, he was better than one of these dogs. And, you know, and he was trying to give up smoking pot, but, I mean, he could walk in a room and look around and he'd know who had joints. He'd just scan the room, and it was amazing, you know. Plus, he could talk them out of it, too. And I mean, and he was trying to give it up, but I mean, it was so developed. And I mean, he came and he told me, he says, "I'm walking down the street and I can just look at somebody and they'll look at me and they'll know that I know they have joints on them." You know, it's like he not only that would give out radar. And so one of the things is that I began to scan through, and every time he would hit one of those experiences, I had him hear the sound of fingernails going across the blackboard. Now, which induces a different set of kinesthetics in him, does in most people. So that as he used that sound, what happened is when he scanned and he heard that sound, instead of making it so he felt like he wanted to get high, it made it so he didn't want to look at them. So he began to avoid those people rather than to seek them out. Now, there's lots of internal mechanisms like that that we can use. Now, I want to jump back to the threshold thing. One of the things that I'd like to do is I'd like you to pick one or two situations in your life where you find yourself hesitating too much from trying new things, saying new things. I found out the government did a research. I love these government. Who gets this money to do this stuff? Why don't they give it to me? Let me throw parties with it. Instead, really, they spent all this money and they did this research to find out what the major psychological problems were in the country. You know, which strikes me as one of them. I mean, that would be a good place to start, whoever's idea that was. Let's find out how fucked up this country really is. I mean, then nothing about how to make it better, you know, or nothing about the people. They didn't talk to the people that didn't have the problem. They isolated out just the ones that did. And they found out that the most pervasive problem in this country is shyness. Think about it. Shyness. 70% of the people that were interviewed, and they did a cross-section of something ridiculous, like 50,000 people in different parts of the country, just to make sure you weren't just fucked up in one part of the country. That they found out that 70% of the people consider themselves shy. And, of course, you know, they weren't very specific about what that means. You know, if you walk up and ask people, "Are you shy?" And they answer, they go, "Yes, I am." You know, I guess they go, they count that as a yes or a no. I don't know. But one of the things that I've noticed is that in terms of people being shy, it runs over into the kind of work that they do in terms of because everybody, when they do NLP, is going to use their own style. But there's a difference between your own style and being a wimp. And this is one of the things. And where people get into the fudge factor is where they wimp out and call it their personal style. Because, I mean, sometimes, you know, a client needs to be told the truth. You know, I mean, when a client comes in and is pissing and moaning and whining, somebody needs to tell them to shut the fuck up. You know, and, you know, that they've been whining for years and it hasn't helped at all. and that you're not going to listen to it. If they want to whine, to go somewhere else, you know. But if they're going to sit there, they're going to answer your questions and do what you tell them to, and not give you any guff. How many times have you told somebody, go inside and remember a time, and they go, but there's this thing I have to tell you first. You ever heard that one? Pretty common. What do you do? I tell them to shut the fuck up and do what I say. You know, I say, you're here because I know how to do something about this, not because you know what I need to know. If you knew what you needed to know, you wouldn't have the damn problem in the first place. So shut up, get inside, and do what I say. And you know, because it's not that they do it maliciously. They do it out of habit, especially if they've had too much therapy. Because, you know, the talking therapies, the question is who gets to talk. And some people have talked their problems into being so fixed and solid, because if you listen to them talk, where you begin to hear is all the semantic ill-forminess, all the cause-effect relationships. I'm this way because for years and years and years. They're that way because they're still doing it, and for no other reason. The reason you are still the way you are is because you keep acting that way. And that's it. I mean, that's you know, don't go no further than that. And what does it take to get you to stop behaving that way? I mean, if you have somebody who hesitates to use skills, I mean, I get clients referred from people who have been through training seminars, and I know they know what to do, but they can't do it because they don't. And that's the only reason. That means they can not do it. You know, that the kind of clients they send me are the people they have trouble dealing with. And that's, you know, and it'd be the best thing in the world for them, you know, to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, fix themselves, and then go back and work with the client. But they don't think about it that way. They think of those clients as being hard, not as the fact that it's an indication about the inflexibility in their behavior. That, you know, I mean, I've had some people that go to my seminars that are real sweet, but these aren't sweet techniques. Sometimes they are. Sometimes being sweet is exactly what you need to do, but sometimes it's not. And having the choice of being one or the other is what allows you to have the skill. Now, I also found out, because I went through this with a group of practitioners, in my practitioner program, there was a whole lot of people that were already master practitioners and trainers that went through it. And they seemed to be having more trouble than the other people, overtrained, you know. And one of the things is that I had discovered is that they had not applied these things to themselves. Because one of the things that was missing was beliefs about where you find limitations in yourself is where you go, oh boy, let the games begin. That they didn't have that built into themselves. That when, you know, when they came up against something that was hard, that their tendency was to move back and start making excuses, to start hesitating. So the thing that we did is what I'm going to ask you to do. What I did is I had them create an alternative universe, which is where you take the things where you know what to do, you know how to act. Like some, you know, with some of them, you know, some of the women and the men, like, they knew how to flirt. They knew what to do, but they couldn't do it when they were out by themselves. I mean, they could demonstrate it in a class, but when it took just like going out by yourself and being that way and enjoying it in public, that was a whole other story. And for them, it's like they knew what to do, but their semantic response stopped them. Now, there's one way is to go through and start removing semantic response, but the other way is to blow it out with threshold. So what I did is have them take whatever the situation is where they hold themselves back and create for themselves 6 months of future experience where that's all there was, and then make time excruciatingly slower and slower and slower and slower, so that time becomes then the threshold variable till they get this thing in there, I am not going to live this way anymore. It's been too long. Now, if you've listened to people talk about having changed, that you'll hear sentences like, I finally got fed up, just said I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, they'll do things like, I looked at my life, you know, and you'll hear either they looked back across it or they looked into the future and they finally just went, I'm fed up, I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, enough is enough. And that phenomenon, a lot of it is built upon being able to do time distortion. Now, for us, we're trying to take the things that occur natural and speed up the process so that somebody doesn't have to take drugs for 20 years. You know, if they've been doing it for a year, we can make it seem like 20 years so that they'll go, fuck it, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a junkie for 20 years. Because, you know, most of them don't live through it. quite frankly. I mean, especially now with the needles, not only can you kill yourself with the drugs, but you can get a fatal disease from the needles alone. You know, that's a new way to scare junkies. Of course, junkies don't scare very well because they don't have good enough memories, because they're all fucked up. But if you can catch them in the state where you can instead spread out time so that you can make 6 months seem like 20 years. Now, what I'd like you to do with your partner is the following. The first thing is, because you don't need to know the content, of course, because this is a workshop, you can do that in your private practice. But the first thing is to identify a context. And the kind of things that I like to do in workshops are things that beef up your ability to do NLP, that make you more ferocious as an individual, that get you to really use your skills and be more flexible. Because when I hear people talk about things like they go, well, boy, I wish I had Richard there to see that client because he would have done this, I know that they know what to do and they could have done it. I mean, that doesn't mean that they need me there. That's like the biggest insult you could possibly give me. It means, well, I learned what to do, but I'm still too much of a wimp to do it. You know, and that means fix yourself. Because if you know what to do and your brain tells you this would work, then do it. And have fun at it. Because it's not enough just to get yourself to do it. You have to be able to put yourself in state. That's why I think one of the major mistakes people do doing NLP is they don't put themselves in the right state to do it. They don't take state-conditioned learning seriously. They don't take a few seconds before the client put themselves in the state where they look at them, where they're all there. They get into a rut, especially the people who see clients every hour. They don't take space between. You know, if you see them for 55, you know, the people in the 55-minute hour have the 5 minutes. And that 5 minutes you should be using to crank yourself up. You know, I mean, me, I don't do it that way. I see clients until I'm done. And I let them know that. You know, it can be quick or it can be long, and I know I can stay awake longer than they can. And I'll do it while they're awake, or I'll do it while they're asleep. Or I'll put them asleep while I'm awake. One or the other, but it's going to happen. And having that determined attitude. See, for example, a lot of people, like when they hear me talk about that, they'll say, well, I know that's right, I know that's the way to believe, but I'm not like that. Well, we're in the business of changing what you're like. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, that you can change. And especially things that have to do with attitude. And attitude is the stuff that goes through time from the inside. It's the kind of stuff that ends up being not only available when you do work, but it ends up running through everything you do. It's that kind of core personality. And, you know, I didn't always have the attitudes that I have now. I wouldn't pop out of the womb and go, hey, motherfuckers, you know, it's not the way it was, you know. That, you know, there was, believe it or not, there was a time in my life where I was shy, right? But I got fed up with it. And, I mean, basically what happened is it just, you know, it was too much trouble. I mean, you know, if you think about how much work it is to be shy and all the time you have to feel bad and you have to feel like everything's a struggle and stuff, you know, whereas you just go, fuck it, you know. If, you know, if things go badly, it's got to be quicker than this, you know. I mean, it does. It's, you know. It's like, you know, when I teach the flirting class, I have to teach men that, you know, you're better off being rejected 100 times in an evening than you are worrying about whether or not you would be rejected once. One is easier. At least you know. You know, I send them out. You know, I go out and sit to see if they can get 100 rejections in an evening. Typically they can't because they can't get through 100 people without getting an acceptance. Of course, then they don't know what to do. Because when they're going through 100, they usually aren't that selective, you know. And they end up getting a yes, and typically they end up getting a yes right out of the gate, you know. And then they're thinking, God, if I go home with her, I'll have to be back out here and get 99 more, or Richard will kill me. And they're right. They go, you do want to go home with me? Well, I can't. I have to be rejected by 99 women. Could you wait? And then when they get a yes to that, it really throws them off. Now, I want you to have the person stop and identify a context in their work where they find themselves having attitudes that slow them down, especially wimping out, because most people wimp out too much. And especially doing NLP, wimping out just makes it take a long time. And NLP has to be done quick, or it doesn't work. You got to get in there and get it done, or you have to do it over again anyway. And because you don't want to let people push you around, if you know what I mean. Other, you know, the easiest way to become a moving towards person is to be fed up with what you're moving away from. Because if you're moving away from people feeling rejected, you know, or feeling like you're mistreating them, then and sit around and let them mistreat you for a long time, that's not a hell of a deal. And, you know, you're better off setting limits about what it is and what the context is and just getting it done. Now, when you identify this, then what I want you to do is to have the person start out by picking one example. And this is an example which is real, okay? Just one example of where it happened. So that, and have them run through it, okay, in slow time. But we'll make this one half speed. Now, the next thing I want you to do is to take and go out onto their timeline, go into the future. Only what we want to do now is to go at fast speed, and we'll make this like 5 or 6 times as fast, if or even faster than that. It's probably about 50 times as fast. I want you to have them build out a month or 2 months of nothing but experiences like this. It's as if you wimped out, if there was the mind police came in and found you wimping out with one client, and you got sentenced to hang out with that client or people just like them for the next 2 months. Lunch, breakfast, dinner, you even had to sleep with one like them. Date one like them. Buy things from the store from people like them. Get waited on by someone like them in a restaurant. I'm talking a full reality of just people that are like this. I mean, we're talking your whole day, your auto mechanic, your dentist, your doctor, your spouse, your children. Everybody acts this way so that you build a nice, full, shitty reality. No time off for bad behavior. Okay? You'll discover, this is kind of fun to do, by the way. I don't know if you've considered this. It may seem awesome to you, but once you go through it, it'll seem fun. Because it gives you a way of beginning, because as you build these scenarios, see, I love doing this with clients, right? Because as I explain to them, they have to do this. Because they always look at me and they go, well, can't we just deal with my problem? And I go, this is your problem. You know, because that is. That, I mean, the fact that they continue to live a way they don't want to is the whole point. Especially when everything inside them is telling them the way they're acting is getting in their own way. You know, this is a way of finding out, do you want to stop it or not? Now, once you've built this reality, this is the fun part. Then come down here, and what you do is go to 1/4 to 1/8 speed. But what you do is you just keep slowing it down and down and down so that you keep decreasing this speed and you run through the 6 months. So you rerun all of this experience right here, but you keep making it slower and slower until they nut up. But they have to stay in it and go through the whole thing. Now, what will happen is there'll be a point where they literally can't, because what will happen is even inside their own mental construction, they will change their behavior and they will be unable to go back. So when they finally crack and they go, well, I'm seeing everything happen differently. What you do is make them go back to the beginning, right? And if they can't do it anymore, then what happens is they can't do it anymore. Because what we're building now is called temporal threshold. And normally in life, this happens slowly and in pieces. But what I discovered that people did when I was modeling how people change things is that when they go through, when they really make life changes, big decision changes, that what they do is they gather together from their history all of the examples of something and rerun them. And they rerun them slower and slower. And sometimes people describe like walking around in a daze for a week, just running over things in their mind over and over and over again until they just couldn't stand it anymore. Now, the thing is that what will happen as you do this, if you remember the exercise we did yesterday that I kind of ran through you a little bit, is it's going to hit a point where it is so humorous they can't do it anymore because it becomes as ridiculous as it is. The thing is when you're doing it in little doses, you don't notice how stupid it is. But when you get a big mouthful like this, what's going to happen is you're going to notice that you really are wasting your time. And what happens is when you get out into the world in the future, it has an interesting future pace built into it. Because when you start to do the same behavior, time will slow down automatically and punish you. This is a good way to change moving away from people, if you know what I mean. Okay, now go ahead and grab yourself a partner. And when you're programming this in the other person, remember, part of your job is to make it sound like it's going to be when you talk about slowing things down. Use congruence and make sure that it seems as heavy as it's going to be, because it has to become so burdensome that it becomes silly. Because remember, what we're after for here is the mechanical part where threshold is broken by utilizing time as a variable. So you want to make sure that everything you do analogically. Now, I also want you to keep in mind this is a hypnotic phenomenon. We're doing time distortion. So from the minute you sit down, as soon as you decide which one of you is going to be doing the work, that's the point at which you start breathing at the same rate, matching tonality. You remember all that hypnosis stuff you learned? All the language patterns and patterns one, presuppositions, all of the stuff you've learned before? You guys remember that? Now! Yes? Okay, all of that stuff is operational. Plus, do what we did yesterday. Put yourself in state before you start. It will help you. Curiosity, exhilaration, all of those things. Take that compression. Step inside it before you start. Take a minute or two for yourself before you begin. But do it now. So how'd you guys do? What?
Well, for me, it was like things just came to a stop. It never got to where I said, fuck it all.
Well, you were running, how slow were you running it?
To where, like, whenever I was in there, it just stopped, almost, and it was like...
Well, if you're supposed to run it slow, you're not supposed to stand still. I know time seems that way sometimes, but I mean it's that when you internally you leave real time the same, and up your subjective time. See, like you have to think about it this way. This is the kind of thing you're after. This is the Milton Erickson diet. Milton Erickson, being somewhat of an unusual and creative clinician. One time, took a lady, and she wanted to learn to lose weight. She was really quite obese, and so what he did is hypnotized her, taught her hypnotic time distortion, and then gave her a post-hypnotic suggestion that when she touched table utensils, she would go into the state of time distortion, and it would take an hour for her to get the fork from the plate to the mouth. But it didn't take an hour. It actually was the same amount of time that it normally took to do it. But subjectively, it seemed like it took an hour. And what it did is it made her bored with the phenomenon of eating. So, you know, that she would try to eat as quickly as possible and get it over with, which meant she didn't eat as much because, you could imagine a bowl of soup. You know, you're there for 16 hours. You ain't going to eat the whole bowl of soup. But, I mean, so that you have to keep, one of the things that makes this work is keeping real time the same so that you don't end up, as you do this exercise, each time you do it, actually taking longer. It's supposed to seem like it takes longer. That's why it's important to amplify the slow time distinctions, the stuff you elicited yesterday, and make sure you use the slow time anchor so that it drags on, but real time stays the same. Because if you do it the other way, it's boring, but it isn't going to create critical mass. Say, if you notice, like when you did the exercise yesterday afternoon, when you did slow time, did you use amplifiers? Okay, when you went through and elicited the difference between slow time and fast time, the next thing to do is to go through it and to amplify the distinctions between the two. so that when you create the sliding anchor, you're creating the sliding anchor by amplifying slow time so that you get ultra slow time. Say now, ultra slow time is useful if you're doing something you enjoy. But if you're doing something like this where you're hesitating where you don't want to, and you make it so that it's excruciating, it has to get to the point where it's painful to be able to watch it. And you also have to do it associated, too. If you did it disassociated, it doesn't have that impact. How many of you found that you got through a threshold to the point where you were just fed up and you just don't want to... You do. Yeah, you can tell by the tone, I did it! You know, are you going to do it again? You know, can you really foresee yourself now? See, the nice thing is when you get into that context now. The other thing is when you use a threshold pattern, when you're working with somebody else, you want to control real time. And I actually clock them when they do it. I go through and clock them so that the first time they run through it, right, and then when they build what the 6 months is, I'll notice if it's 2 minutes long. And then if they slow it down and the next time it takes 4 minutes, they're not actually changing. They're changing the length of time they take to do it. They're not changing their subjective experience. So what I'll do is go back in, crank up the submodalities of slow time more, fire the anchor off, and literally as they go through, I'll go, you should be 1/4 of the way through, you should be 1/2 way through, done now. And if they're not done, then I make them go back and do it again so that you build an external sense that controls time. When you teach people hypnotic time distortion anyway, you need to be able to build real blips that way so that they actually do time distortion. When we were running experimental hypnosis groups, what we used to do is we had people watch a 10-minute movie. And then what we do is have them go in and replay the movie in their head, but have them do it 5 minutes. And then we'd have them do it in 2.5 and keep cutting it down until they could get it down into a matter of 10 seconds. But their experience had to stay the same. They couldn't just speed the movie up to the point where they couldn't hear it. They have to actually subjectively distort time. And that's part of the thing but that's not having it feel fast or slow when you do time distortion. It's supposed to seem normal. Because just like you can do fast or slow time, you can also hold normal time the same. This is one of the things, by the way, if you don't have a lot of time to work with people, that's one of the things that's a handy thing to teach your clients, is you can get a lot more done. You can never go back and review shit. They do it like this instead of taking hours to do it. We used to do things like when we made pervasive changes, a lot of times we'd have people go back and go through their life and recode it in relationship to the changes, literally go way back to when they're 2 or 3 years old and come all the way up through their timeline. And if you do that state of time distortion, you can lift up their hand, tell them to go down only as fast as they go back and recode their whole life. And then you can walk away and come back in 10 minutes, they're done. If you come back, and they're still like this, and you go, how old are you? And they go, I'm still 5. They're not doing it in the state of time distortion, and they could be there for, another 30 years, which is not what I call the most efficient session, although it's more efficient than some therapies. I've had some clients this year, and I started doing a thing with my clients at the beginning of the year where I had them go through their checkbook and find out. And I had them do two things. One, write down how much money they had spent on a problem, and then in the other column, how much time they'd spent. So that if it took them an hour to drive to the session, and they spent an hour or two in the session, and an hour to drive back, and whether it was a work day or not. So if they had lost time from work that wasn't paid for, they added that on the money list. And I did that with the first 15 or 20 clients I got this year, and the sums were astronomical. I mean, one guy was like $180,000, and he'd been working with one problem for 16 years. I mean, 16 years fucking around with the same problem, and $180,000. I mean, this is not a problem you could have if you were poor, or at least you'd have to just keep it or something or change it on your own. He had a thing where if people cleared their throat, he became furious. Built-in response. And, of course, I had to ask him about that. when you think just something like that, and his problem was it interfered with his business because he'd go into meetings and stuff and people would clear their throat and he'd throw temper tantrums. And, which is not the best way to be a salesman, just the incredible amount of time that people spend on stuff, that if they're going to spend the amount of time, and I mean, he even at this point, he said, I finally decided to come and see you because I would be willing to try anything. I don't know if that was a compliment or not. I didn't quite know how to take that. It's like, I always get this from people. They always go, I went to all the normal, mechanisms, and then I figured, shit, I'd try anything. I'd even come see you, But I always go, thanks a lot, you know. That one of the things is that if you consider the amount of time and money this guy spent on this thing, that if you can compress that into something like we're doing here, to the point where people get fed up. Now, getting fed up isn't all there is to it, because then the question is, what do you do next? Because now when you're in that context, this is the point where you need to be able, and this is where I start building in what I consider layers. Because as soon as you get people to the point where they threshold them with any difficulty, then you have to start layering in front of it what it is that they're going to do. And see, to me, this is the real difference between elegant work, between just using a technique. Whether you cure somebody of a phobia, well, if you cure them of a phobia, some of them will come back. And there are different characteristics to phobias. Like an elevator phobia, I mean, going in an elevator and being bored like everybody else, it's just up the, you know, or down. But if you have them be curious, then if they get in a glass elevator, it won't be, you know. Because if you do the elevator cure, the one thing is when you run them through in their mind, always do a 70-story glass elevator. Do worst-case scenarios. Now, the thing is what we just did here has built into it worst-case scenarios. I mean, when you start, gee, I noticed some of you are nodding. You know, when you start having lunch, breakfast, and dinner, you know, and stuff with the situations, it has a tendency to make you less tolerant. And especially when you're doing something like this, where you're programming yourself to be able, see, like with salespeople, I do this a lot. There's what I find when I teach sales, that there's a class of people that people can sell to, and then there's a whole class of people that they just can't. And their tendency is to just try to increase the number of people they see, which is the fastest way to a coronary, instead of increase their interest, that they don't look at those people as the laboratory of learning. And that this kind of an attitude change, because, see, the next piece for me is because you can be fed up with the kind of person. And you can be fed up with the way you treat them. But the next thing is an attitude change. And attitude changes, to me, have a couple of different components to it. One is that you need to always build in a couple of beliefs. For example, you need to build in a belief that in essence reframes whatever it is in some useful context. When I worked with salespeople and I found out that there was somebody like that, that if instead what they could do is build a belief that it was an obligation to their own health, their own welfare, and their economic success to view these people as a learning laboratory. Say, and to me, I try to install the same kind of thing in people that are doing NLP. That whenever there's anybody where there's a difficulty, instead of like being, you know, over obsessed with changing them, especially if you don't know what to do, because when you don't know what to do, this is instead of going, oh my God, this is the time to go, this is where I'm going to change my skill level. Because, see, as a professional, you have an obligation to get better at what you do, and not just in workshops, but by taking the things that are difficult and viewing them as a learning opportunity and as a challenge. And that's where you really need to build in tenacity. That's where you go after them. I mean, like a pit bull. And so if you stop right now and begin to think that an attitude is built out of a couple of different pieces. One is there'll always be a couple of underlying beliefs. And most you guys all know the belief change in here, right? You guys know how to do that? You don't know how to do it, but you're about to find out. Just get a partner. Make sure your partner knows what they're doing. Ask him if he believes he knows how to do it. If he's incongruent, pick a new partner. What we want to do now is we want to start to build attitudes. Okay, now, attitudes have component pieces. One is you're going to have to build in a couple of underlying beliefs. Okay? Now, depending upon what kind of change it is, and given that hopefully there's some uniformity in this group, you know how to spell the word. You'll live through it. It's just a way of torturing visuals. Pay them back for having put those red marks next to things when I was young. Visuals are so much fun to play with. I've been working with a guy that's a movie maker. He's a producer. And I mean, you don't get any more visual than this guy is. I mean, this guy has to see 3 movies a day or he goes through withdrawal symptoms. Has a theater in his house, spends all of his time editing movies. He's totally Mr. Visual. And for him to have to work with me is probably the most painful thing in his life. because, you know, he this is the kind of guy that when he was waiting in my office for me, cleaned my desk, ordered all the papers up. When I come in and sit down, I went, and I said, now I can find things. But it hurts him to sit and watch. That's being a little too, being visual external is not a good idea. If you think about it, if the way the outside world affects your internal feelings, then you have to control the world. That's why he's a producer. And as long as he's a producer, he can do that. But if you think about it, because like one of the things that always amazed me is people that suffer if a house is dirty. Or I had a friend that would come over, and if you smoked and put a cigarette in an ashtray, he would literally at your house pick up the ashtray, empty it, wash it out in the sink without ever breaking. He didn't even know he did it. But the outside world had to be organized. It's the kind of person when you walked in his bathroom, the toothbrush was lined and facing in one direction, the toothpaste was next to it, then the mouthwash. You could tell the order in which he did things. You know. What I do is I go in and I move them around. So he'd come in and he'd know something was wrong, but he couldn't tell what it was. Now, the thing is the first thing we want to do is to build a couple of powerful beliefs. And for the example we'll use here, and I mean with clients, it will depend upon what it is, the change that you're making. So you're going to need some content to determine what kinds of beliefs would be useful. And if you think about the choice of beliefs as being the same thing as what they call contextual reframing. Contextual reframing is an attempt to build a belief. When you do a good reframe with people, you know, when somebody comes in and goes, well, you know, I just can't stand, you know, these people, they come in, you know, and they walk into a stereo store, but they don't really want to buy something, you know. And if you looked at them and said, yes, but if you thought of it as a rare and unprecedented opportunity to enrich and increase your skills, that's the verbal form of reframing. Now, the shit-kicking way of reframing that is to not just say it, but to build the damn belief in, to find out what the strongest belief that they have is. And I mean, when you want to use a belief that they have and do elicitation with submodalities, you don't pick a wimpy belief. You know, don't pick, you know, well, you know, I believe the Broncos are the best football team. You don't pick a belief like that. You pick something like, you know, if I don't breathe, I'll die. But if you really want a good example, you know, if you say, well, you believe if you don't breathe, you'll die, the person hesitates. What you do is pull out a piece of rope with a knot in it, like this, and walk towards their throat. And when they access, that'll be where the belief is. Because, I mean, you can really tell, I mean, with people, I mean, the length that they focus their eyes, whether they move their eyes to the right and left. And, I mean, if you really begin when you do elicitation to start pay attention to these cues, it will expedite things for you because, you know, you just want the information, whether it's told to you or not, is unimportant. So the faster you can do elicitation, the faster you can get this kind of stuff done. Now, the thing about the beliefs is the first kind of belief that we want is we want the submodalities of a strong belief so that we can build in a belief. Now, the thing is when you're changing beliefs, like the stuff in using your brain for a change, basically you're taking a belief, making it go away, and building in a new one. Now, in this case, you may have the opportunity to do that because there may be an underlying belief that these people don't, if somebody, you know, tells you, well, the person doesn't really want, they come in a store, they don't really want to buy anything, right? Well, for me, that doesn't matter. I don't use that as an opportunity to change beliefs because, to me, it doesn't matter whether they want to or not. Because if they come in not wanting to buy something, shouldn't have anything to do with whether you sell them something or not. Your job is to sell things, and it's the largest profession in the country. And yet you can't get a college degree in it. Isn't that odd? You can get a college degree in poetry? Right? Because they always tell me, well, I hear stuff from people when I bring this up when I work at colleges. They say things to me like, well, to have a degree in sales, you know, like that's not a serious discipline, but poetry is. I mean, you can get a degree in improvisational dance. I mean, think about it. You can get a degree in improvisational dance, and you cannot get a degree in sales, and it's the largest damn profession in the country. Silly things. That's why they call them academic colleges. Now, the thing is to me that when your job is to sell something, it's not a question. If they come in, as long as you know they don't want to buy something, then you know the first step is to make them want to. And that's not a hard thing to do, to make human beings want things. If you think about it, you just ask them, have you ever just looked at something and you knew you had to have it? I mean, just looked at it and, boy, you know what I mean? Ever had this feeling? Well, I want you to look at that over there. I mean, it's tough to do, huh? Can you see this? Would be useful. Now, what we want to do is to begin to build in a belief. Now, when building in a belief where you're not really taking one away, once you know what the submodalities are of the belief, then basically what you do is you have somebody start out by literally constructing, like, and I do it with an if-then. I go, if you were to believe this, right, what would image? Because, you know, some people, their beliefs are stills and some are movies. And to me, that's the first consideration I need to know about, because I need to know how to formate the content that's going to become a belief. And what I do is I have them pick an arbitrary place, right? So if their belief is over here, I pick some arbitrary place in the middle. And if it's a movie, then I have them make a movie here. If it's a slide, I have them make a slide here. And then literally, then move it off from an arbitrary point, have them pull it up to where the belief is. And when it comes in, I use the sound of a bolt slamming shut. Now, the thing is that it's not much difference than the normal belief change. But by building in a belief, only this time we want to build in a set of beliefs. And the easiest way to build in a set of beliefs is if there are two or three, you build them one right after another, and then you make it so that they are connected together. Literally, when you see one, the other one pops out from inside of it, just to open it up, whoosh, so that in essence they chain pretty much the way we chained stuff yesterday. Because having an operational set of beliefs, you want to start with a foundation belief. And, for example, in the context we have here, you want to have a solid foundation that says that all of the people that are difficult for you are an opportunity to learn. Now, as well as not only do we want to build a belief, but we want to build the feeling that goes with the belief. And this is where I find when people build beliefs where they miss the boat. When you build a belief, see, if you build a thing that says that these people are an opportunity to learn, the feeling that people have with the belief might be, oh, God. See, it still doesn't build in necessarily. So you also want to build for yourself a powerful anchor so that you have an anchor for which feelings, so that you have one that when they view somebody that's difficult as an opportunity to learn, they have drooling desire to learn it. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, it's an opportunity to learn, but for some people that is not a ferociously fun thing. I mean, you know, a lot of people when they have an opportunity to learn, it's a struggle. That people believe that learning has to be hard and difficult and all that stuff. So there's going to be two parts. One is going to be building the belief, and the other is going to be building the anchor that you want to go with the belief, so that when you slam the picture up into the right things that make it so they absolutely believe it, you also put the feelings with it as well at the same time. So here you're going to try and find a set of submodalities and amplify the shit out of it and anchor it. So that, in essence, what you're going to do is build a very powerful sliding anchor so that for something that is irresistible, and I mean, you know, it's like if there's an opportunity to learn, you don't want somebody to go, okay, there's an opportunity to learn something. You know, you want somebody to have the same response that maybe they have to Godiva chocolate, you know, or to wanton sex. Little things like that. I'm sure something will rubbage into your mind. But once you find this, okay, again, you're going to amplify and build a sliding anchor. Then what you do is you pull these two together. So you pull the submodalities of the belief and fire off your sliding anchor simultaneously, building in the belief. And the belief is about whatever the last thing was that you had drudgery. Because now what we're doing is we're layering. First thing is when you go through a threshold or you use the phobia pattern or any of those things, the next thing in terms of building a system which propels people into the future is to give them a solid foundation of beliefs and feelings that go into the future. So you also want to connect this with timelines, because you want to put this new learning into the future as well. Now, with me, I also layer it deeper, because what I usually do is I do about three of these, because I also want to have, you know, that challenge is fun. And I also want to put in there something about mystery. The fact that you don't understand makes it a mystery that has wanton curiosity. So I put challenge is fun, and that it's an opportunity to step into the mysterious. Because it's mysterious that somebody could not see. To me, like when I train people to do telemarketing, I want them to have the belief that the person who picks up on the phone on the other side, that this is the most important thing that they could possibly be doing. Now, see, the nice thing about beliefs is they don't have to be true. You have to keep that in mind. They're operational. They guide your behavior. And if you're doing telemarketing, if that's your job, if you believe the most important thing that could happen to this person is that they could answer the phone, such that if nobody answers the phone, you feel sorry for them, then this is going to make you a ferocious telemarketer. It's going to change, you know, it's going to be like if nobody answers the phone, instead of going, oh shit, they're not there, you're going to go, the poor person, I have to write their number down and call them back. Now, this is the kind of training that I find makes salesmen much more powerful in what they do. Now, the same thing is true for me when I'm working with people, that when I work with clients, to me, I'm always trying to layer in sets of things that make them ferocious about just enjoying themselves. That especially, you know, a lot of my clients, whatever their problem has made them a wallflower through life. I mean, imagine the social phobic I was telling you about. I mean, this guy has been the ultimate wallflower his whole life. I mean, he not only didn't ask anybody to dance, he couldn't get in the room. But, I mean, if he got in the room and then sat on the wall and was a wallflower, to me, this is not success. He wasn't scared of people, but he's no fun. And there's enough boring people in the world as it is already. That I want to build in him a belief that, given the fact that he felt left out of everything, that gives him the obligation to not be an asshole. And when I said that to him, he looked at me and he went, what? And I said, look, now that you don't have this problem, whenever you look around and you see somebody that's a wallflower in some place or somebody that's nervous, you now have an obligation. Because if you know how bad it feels, then you should walk over and ask them to dance. Otherwise, you're just a prick, a self-centered one at that. Yeah, it's an interesting reframe, isn't it? Well, this is the way I deal with shy people. I tell them they're pricks. Right? If they know that it feels this bad and they let other people feel this way, then they must hate people. It's interesting to watch their brain warp when you use that logic. But it is as logical as their logic. But you have to understand, logic is something that sounds like it makes sense. And there's a real difference because most of their logic is junko logic too. So when I use junko logic, I'm just setting up building in a belief. Because then what I'm going to do is, because I want them to believe when they see somebody that this is their opportunity to relieve someone else's suffering and that it's a moral obligation because they've suffered this much. Otherwise, they're just being cruel. Do you enjoy being cruel to people? You do, but I asked the wrong, yeah, sure, you know. But when you ask somebody who's been a wallflower for years, they would go, oh, no. And I go, then you get out there and do it. In fact, you know, because I want them, when they look at somebody, to switch referential index. Because the truth is, if you think about it, what makes my logic work is the wallflower is so self-centered, they don't think about the other people in the place. That's what makes it so they could sit there. And the fact is that if they switch referential index, they won't be paying attention to the fact they're nervous or afraid, so they'll get out and do something. Now, in our context, if just for the sake of practicing, if you build these beliefs, and if you'd first do them one at a time, and then layer them together the way we did yesterday. Remember what we did yesterday where you went out on the timeline, you took the three sets of submodalities, right, stacked them together in the future and pulled them closer and closer together? You guys remember yesterday? Okay, that's the last step here. Because, see, one of the things I do when I do training workshops is as I teach people to do things, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but I teach you to do something, and then the next day I teach you to do something, and then you add that piece onto it. I teach technology in reverse. But one of the things is if I didn't do it that way, what would happen is it doesn't integrate as well. Because now that you know the hard part at the end, it should be a piece of cake. Because now, yesterday when you did the exercise, it didn't give you the foundation to know what to use it for. And see, this is one of the, well, a lot of people learn techniques, but they don't know what to use them for. The decision is about what to use it for now is to first, the example is where you find somebody living their life a way they don't want to, and they know they're going to do it in the future. And that pretty much sums up most of what you're going to get. Is that people don't, I mean, every once in a while you get somebody that wants things more the way they are. But I only get one every 5 years as a client. You know, I got a guy that came in, great client. Guy comes in, and I said, well, you know, what's wrong? And he went, nothing. And I said, well, did you just drop by to pay me this money? And he said, no. He said, I love my wife, I enjoy it, but I want my feelings to be 10 times as intense. Now I thought, we can do that. Of course, then I got a call from his wife afterwards. About 3 weeks later, she called up. She wanted to know when she got her turn. She sounded pissed off. He was having too much fun. She didn't feel, if he's going to enjoy himself that much, then I am too. Now, that's the kind of conflict that should be in relationships. It's a contest of who's going to enjoy themselves the most. Just a thought. Okay, now, if you build these three beliefs complete with, and I want these anchors to be fucking dynamite anchors, because when you build a belief in, it will be a strong belief, but to make it operational in behavior, you want to put feelings with it that are propelling feelings. That, you know, when you anchor, you know, because you can build a belief that challenges fun, but that doesn't make it fun. Say, I mean, a lot of people can believe challenge is fun for Richard. Do you understand why it's important that you do the anchoring when you build beliefs? Okay, because otherwise it is fun, but not for me. It becomes disassociated. And when you want to pull in and associate states with beliefs, the best way to do it is with anchors that when you fire them off, the person trembles. That's how you can tell a good anchor. If the person goes, yeah, all right, that ain't good enough. You go back. So you want to make sure the anchor that you have for fun is one that makes it to the point where you can see their pulse beat in their neck. You want to find something where somebody got a turn and they were only good, and there was a chance. You know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, you put your number down on the roulette wheel and spin it and you see the balls bouncing right up to your hole and it hangs on. Have you ever watched that? Like in California, we have the lottery, they have a thing called the big spin, right? And they spin this thing and just at the end, the ball will stick and it'll like drop in a million and it'll kind of go up like this. And everybody in the place is going, stay there, and it goes up, and it may fall out or it may stay there. You want something that is just an exhilarating opportunity. You know, it's the kind of thing, do they have the scratch-off things in this state? Scratch-off things? Have you ever scratched off one and looked at it wrong and thought you won? No, in fact, people do that all the time. I watch them do it in bars and stuff all the time in California. They scratch it off, and they go, $25,000, and then they go, oh, no, that's the wrong. It's just before the second response. It's the one where they go, ah! That's the kind of thing that you're looking for right here. You want a lit up one. Now, the thing about things that are mysterious is not mysterious bad, but the thing where mystery is good. I mean, the thing that something is so marvelous. I mean, it's like when you first start studying it, like how genetics work. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. When I met Gregory Bateson, he was writing a book on mimicry. And I didn't know anything about it. I never thought about mimicry. I just, you know, not being into biology or anything, I never thought about it. And he had a big refectory table, and he had all these pairs of pictures of butterflies that looked like plants and all these different things. And then he had a set of equations that literally made it mathematically impossible to do this by natural selection, that it would have taken millions and millions and millions of more years for it to even happen randomly. Just couldn't happen that way. And the fact that he had like 3,000 documented cases of mimicry, and some of them were just fucking phenomenal. I mean, you know, you'd look at them, and you know, and of course, to me, when I looked, since they were such good mimicry, they could have been two pictures of the same thing, for all I know. But he had one that was butterfly, and the other was plant, you know. And if he didn't have that written on there, I wouldn't have been able to tell. And you know, and then underneath, like when you lift up the one, then the butterfly would be flying, and the plant would be standing still. There's a reason for that. But I mean, when I went through that, I mean, it gave me a sense of mystery about the way nature works, that was where you just marvel at something. That sometimes, you know, if I mean, when I first learned how an engine works, you know, I mean, it was a marvelous thing. And I mean, that anything that you found that's like that, if you've ever seen a baby born, the first time I saw one of the, they have these things now where you can watch the baby inside of a mother, and that's a really incredible thing. I mean, you know, it's just awe-inspiring. This is the kind of response that you want. And when you find the submodalities of it, you want to amplify it and build an anchor. Then you go through and you build the three beliefs with the anchors, and then you layer them together in the future the same way we did yesterday. Okay? Now, I don't want you to make this into Gone with the Wind. Remember, keep moving fast. You don't have to go through and elicit every submodality, just the big ones, just the difference that makes a difference, and amplify the hell out of it. And make sure that you have a good, strong, solid belief, one where there is no ambiguity about it. And that means you can pick simple stuff, you know, like breathing helps you to live, you know. The sun will rise tomorrow. Some people even have doubts about that. But stuff, pick real basic stuff, because it makes your work simpler. Because if you take stuff that's beliefs that are opinion beliefs, something that one person believes and the other doesn't, then you end up having ambiguity. So pick simple, solid stuff. It makes your work easier. Okay? Now, when you do this, I want you to just power through it. Okay? Because it's not just these techniques individually. Remember, when you do this kind of stuff, it's connecting it all together in a package that makes it work. So I want you to try and get this done by taking 20 minutes apiece max. Okay? So just keep moving, and if your client tries to talk to you too much, use chutzpah to shut them up and just have them answer your questions, do what you want, and don't get into babble discussions, okay? Especially about what the instructions are.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, you may.
Is there one belief or three beliefs?
Three.
Okay. And what, I mean, is it supposed to be reflective of the ink, the content?
No, it's not reflective of it at all. It is... See, a belief that difficult clients are an opportunity to learn could be a good feeling or a bad feeling. What we're going to do is make it a good feeling. It's not that it is reflective of it.
So,
we're going to make it the way we want it.
So there are just three basic beliefs.
Well, these are the three beliefs we're using here. But when you're working with a client, you may use three different beliefs.
Got it.
Okay. We're picking three so that you concentrate on learning the skill, rather than choosing the beliefs. With some other change with a client, it might be different beliefs.
It's the submodalities of just a normal belief that you elicit.
Well, first you get the submodalities of a solid
right,
belief.
Right,
then you're
right.
Going to build in these three beliefs with three totally powerful anchors. And then you're going to layer them together by using the exercise we did yesterday so that it propels itself into the future through time. See, what we're building here is a new attitude about how to do things. And because I find that the most important part of working with clients is changing their attitude more than solving their problem. Because their problem is almost symptomatic of an attitude change. Because their problem is always a reflection of a good example of what it is that's the difference between, it's the emphasis that they put on the past as opposed to on the future. As opposed to just, you know, pulling out in the fast lane, you put the fun meter to the red line, making sparks off the guardrail and making their life, you know, full of ecstasy and better every day, they're trying to solve a problem that existed in the past. I mean, and I realize, because I've taken clients and just given them amnesia for having had the problem. But it doesn't do anything to make it so that they make their life the best it can be. And, you know, I figure if you're going to see them, you might as well shoot for everything you can get as quick as you can get it. Otherwise, you have to see them week in and week out, listen to them drivel and snivel and complain. And it's up to you. Total ecstasy or listening to drivel and complaining. I mean, you guys choose. Okay, get going. How'd you guys do? Went real well. Now, I also wanted to understand if you're gaining the concept that, see, I know that over the years you've learned a lot of techniques. And I know that, especially in my teaching, that a lot of what I do is I go in and I teach for 2 or 3 days. And what I try to do is give people a wealth of tools that fill up their bag, you know. I mean, a lot of times, I mean, especially, you know, the first 10 years, I go around to teach people things like anchoring and, like, to watch their client and stuff. Like, to listen to what they say and notice, like, you know, some of them talk in words that have to do with pictures and sounds. And you'd be surprised how blown out people were by the concept of rep systems. I mean, and to me, it's like, you know, they had all of these disciplines, like active listening, as opposed to just listening. active listening is where you distort everything your client tells you, right? So it fits your feelings. well, it does. I mean, you know, there's Rogerian therapy, which is where you mismatch all visual clients. every visual statement they make, you make a kinesthetic one back, thereby making rapport take years until your client can finally adjust themselves. Once the client learns to speak in feeling languages, then you can communicate, and they're cured, and you feel better. Yeah. I always love, I met, one of my favorite clinicians I ever met was a lady named Alice Elliott, and she was a counselor in San Diego, and she went to like two or three workshops, and then she sent me this letter, and the letter was, you know, I learned the techniques, they work so well, I tried them on myself, made all the changes I need, so I thank my clients very much and quit. It was a very honest response. She decided that she was dependent on her clients, that she didn't really like doing therapy anyway. And now that she felt better, that she just wanted, if I could send a list of people she could refer them to, that she decided that she made herself feel so good, she didn't want to hang around with them because they were all very depressing, unhappy people. Now, the thing that I'd like to get across to you in the course of this is that above and beyond having techniques that are just techniques, is the way in which you can begin to lace and layer these things together to build what I call a complex. And a complex has to do with building belief systems, with building feelings, with layering in chains, because even in this one thing as the exercise, to me it doesn't even constitute a whole unit of what I would do, but it's the way in which I begin to lace together different things you've already learned about. You've learned about elicitation, submodality, timelines, but to me, in order to teach them, you have to separate them out to teach them. But it's packaging them together. And the where you really get to get creative with NLP is where you begin to build packages so that you begin to build what I refer to as safety systems. Like, you know, in a nuclear power plant, they always talk about backup systems. Well, these are the systems that would go in front. Instead of having it so that if the first one fails, there's something that might fix it. This is where you have things that fix it before it breaks. So that as you begin to change what's a difficulty for someone, so that if you understand how convincer strategies work, that you can utilize, because see, if you can take somebody and fix an elevator phobia or some kind of a compulsion, you may be able to reduce it a certain percentage, but not entirely. But even if you can get a small amount of it and use it as a convincer that everything is going to change and get them to really start having more positive attitude towards changing, towards learning, towards living, and towards the way they treat other people. Because one of the major things that I discover is that when people have something that they're stuck on, they use it as an excuse to be unpleasant to other people, which means they don't have really good relationships. That, you know, I mean, think about, like, I was just talking about the agoraphobic that I saw, and that told her that I'd take her out to lunch and work with her, otherwise she had to pay full fee. So it's like somebody coming out of the house like this. Of course, when she got out and wasn't afraid, she figured I did something to her. Of course, I was such an asshole. I said, maybe you haven't been afraid all these years. You know, I always like to make them, because when they have to stop and wonder about that, you know, it's like maybe just the few things I said to you didn't really have any impact, and you've been waiting here for 5 years. Maybe you were fixed 4 years ago. Because the fact is when I asked her when the last time she tried to leave the house was, she said about 3 or 4 years ago. And you guys remember, those of you who've seen the Marshall University tapes, you remember Lee, the guy that had the phobia of driving out of town? Okay, here's a guy that has a phobia of driving out of town. If you remember on the film, I asked him, I said, well, maybe it was just that road. How many roads are there out of town? And he said, well, you know, he says there's like 4 or 5 ways. And I said, have you tried them all? And he went, yeah, I tried them all. And I said, well, you know, how long have you had this? And he said, 8 years. And I said, in that time, I said, how many times have you tried to leave town? And he said, well, 5 or 6. Now, this isn't what I call a balls-on person, you know. And, I mean, to me, it was getting him that day to drive out of town. And maybe, my guess is, having watched the beads of sweat pour off his face when I suggested it, that he probably still had the phobia. But, you know, even after using the phobia thing, I wanted to install in him, and one of the things I said to him that isn't on the film, it's after the session, because he came up to me and said, geez, Richard, this is, that's so amazing, you know. All we did was just sit there and talk. And I said, yes, but it's how you talk. But I suggested to him, I said, you know, when was the last time you actually tried to leave town? And he said, well, it's been a few years. I said, maybe this went away on its own. And I said, and this is where I begin to layer things. I said, maybe there's lots of things that you haven't tried in a while that would be worth trying. Because it's not just being able to leave town. Even on the film, I said, well, now that you're not afraid, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I'd like to take my family on a vacation. And I said, where? Because I want to make sure that he does something. Because I wanted to open up the possibility that he could get better jobs. He could take his family places. You know, he could go to dinner at new restaurants. I mean,